Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome, everybody. Really a great pleasure to welcome all of you to this hybrid event this evening, which forms part of the LSE Festival, Power and Politics. The festival, as you probably know, is taking place from Monday the 10th through Friday the 15th, and is exploring how politics and power shape our world. My name is Jonathan Leap. I'm the Executive Director of the International Growth Center, which is a growth center here at the school, but with offices across Africa and South Asia. I'm very pleased to welcome tonight's speaker, Paul Collier, both to our online audience and those of you here in the room. Paul is a professor of economics and public policy at Oxford at the Blavatnik School of Government. He's no doubt known to at least many of you as the author of a number of books, which I think we can say have changed both how we think and how we talk about some important issues. Among the most known of these are his book, The Bottom Billion, and more recently, The Future of Capitalism, and both have been very widely translated. Less known publicly, Paul is an inspiring teacher and mentor, and I think there are many people around the world that I've met who really credit him with having launched their careers. He's also a respected advisor to heads of government in Africa particularly, but also more broadly. From my perspective, his most important role is that he's a director of the International Growth Center. He's the Oxford director. We're a joint center between LSE and Oxford, and has played an instrumental role since our founding back in 2008 in shaping the program. And currently, we're working very closely in Zambia, which is, you may know, is one of the examples he refers to in his book, where there's an exciting reformist new president who's taking on a very ambitious transformation program inspired by many of these ideas we'll talk about this evening. We'll be talking about Neglected Places, which is Paul's, Left Behind, the A New Economics for Neglected Places, which is Paul's new book. For those who are on Twitter, the hashtag for today's event is #LSEFestival. I'd ask you please to make sure your phones are on silent so we don't disrupt the event. The event is being recorded, so barring any technical hitches, we expect to have a podcast available later. We're going to start with a conversation for roughly the first half hour, and then I'll open it up to questions and answer from all of you. For those of you in the room, there'll be roving mics, and we'll take three questions at a time. For those of you online, we have someone here in front who will be gathering your questions and then asking them on your behalf. Please do give your name and affiliation, if possible, when you ask a question. Well, before we get into the core arguments of the book, and there's a lot to talk about there, I want to start, Paul, with a somewhat more personal question. You published a blog in the LSE blog series on Tuesday, and reading the blog, in contrast to the polite tones that we usually have these conversations in this room, reading the blog, there's an unmistakable anger that runs through it. Why?
Yeah, there is. The first third of the book is a pretty angry book. I think there's much to be angry about in Britain. We're just coming up to an election, and so I'm going to focus not on the work I do with Jonathan, though I'm happy to talk about that. With Jonathan, I focus on a much wider audience, the world, really, but especially the part of the world which is full of poor communities, poor countries that have been left behind. But the anger and in that pod that I did was focused on my own country, Britain, because there's great tracts of Britain that are left behind. I grew up in one. I grew up in Sheffield, which is now the poorest city in England. It didn't used to be. It used to be a city of great pride, very justifiable pride, because it was the birth of the Industrial Revolution. The first factory on earth, which is recognised as the first factory that launched the Industrial Revolution, is 10 miles from where I was born. It's now a UNICEF World Heritage Centre, quite justifiably. There was pride there. The main theatre in Sheffield is called the Crucible, in acknowledgement of what the city did, which was forge very high-quality steel. Sheffield has first done that 700 years ago. It's in Chaucer, it's the Sheffield knife. So here was a city that had a long tradition of steel, and it was an forging. That forging process was a spectacular and very demanding process. Just to explain it to you in a minute, you had to throw in ore and then heat it very hot. And the ore, each load of iron ore, had a subtly different composition. And the steelworkers of Sheffield were able to tell from the hue of that glow, with years of experience, just what was missing from that particular consignment of ore, what needed to be added. They weren't well-educated people, but it was a spectacularly skilled job, and they took pride in it, not just individual pride, but collective pride. This was what I call a community of work, which gave people huge pride in the skill that they'd got. And that was the Sheffield I knew. And now it's a broken community. It's spiraled down. People have lost that sense of pride in their city. And that is a tragedy. And it's also a completely avoidable tragedy. In the book, I compare what happened with Sheffield and its steel with what happened in America, where steel industry did get hit but revived, and what happened in Germany, where the steel industry was so supported, because Germany, unlike Britain, is devolved. Britain is ludicrously highly centralized. And so in Britain, and England uniquely, the civil service, Whitehall used to rule half the bloody world very badly. It gradually shrunk, first to Britain and then to England, as the other bits of Britain managed to get a modicum of devolved power. And what a mess that Whitehall managed to make of that process. So yes, I'm angry. Let me give you one more Sheffield story before we move on, and that is the foundation of Sheffield University, which is a story I love. We're going to go back to 1904. And Sheffield University was founded by an alliance between the biggest steel baron, a man called Firth, and the steel trades unions. And they got together, and the steel trade unions said, well, we will do a voluntary levy on all our members, the steel workers in Sheffield. And Firth said, I'll match, pound for pound, whatever the workers raise. Right? Although it was voluntary levy, virtually everybody contributed. Everybody. Now, if it had been 500 years earlier, what would they have been funding? They'd have been funding a cathedral. But this was 1904, and these steelworkers had a very good intelligence that although they hadn't had a chance to get education, the future for their children and their grandchildren was going to be education. And so what they wanted was a university, and now Sheffield University, which that was the endowment that they raised. It endowed Sheffield University. It's now one of the top 100 research universities in the world. It was a fantastic achievement, built jointly. So was this evil capitalism? No, this was capitalism at its best. Yeah? You're mostly students, and so you're hardwired to think that capitalism is evil. Capitalism's pretty awful until you try communism, which doesn't seem to work very well either. But not all capitalism has to be like that. The shit it is now, right? There is I around Europe there are examples of very much more equal societies that are more prosperous than Britain but have equal life chances. In Britain we've managed to get spectacularly unequal life chances, and one of the big dimensions of unequal life chances is geography. If you grow up in Sheffield now with the wrong sort of parents, in the sense that they haven't been to university, then your prospects are really very poor. Your life chances are dismal. Right? The gap between the golden people who were kind of grew up in London, where the jobs are, and had educated parents who gave them a big opportunity in life, their chances, the gilded youth, are very high, and the chances of those people left behind are pathetic. And that gulf in life chances is what makes me angry. And I think any young person who's anxious about their future will share that sense of that anxiety is needless anxiety. This country could be so much more prosperous and so much fairer, and it isn't.
Sorry, that was a very long answer. That's okay. But we do have a lot to cover, so let's get into the argument. So the first section of your book, as you say, sets out the problem and the causes, called Spiraling Down. So I wonder if you could just very briefly just complete the pen sketch of what's wrong. So you've talked a bit about the neglected places in the UK, but it's a bigger problem than that. So a little bit about the bottom billion, about emerging economies. But then jump into the first part of the why that's happened. So you really point at traditional economic policies having failed these regions, but that combined with centralized decision-making. So I wonder if you could just complete the pen sketch of the problem, but then say, okay, what's that first core reason why it happened?
Yeah, so there are left-behind communities all around the world, sometimes in places that are the countries which are really doing very well. I work part of the year in Colombia. I'm a regular visitor to Colombia, Latin American Colombia. And that's a very successful middle-income country, growing very fast. It's been growing fast for years, but there are two regions, the two coastal regions, which have been badly left behind. And I work with one of them, the Atlantic Caribbean, whose capital is Barranquilla. And that place has used to be the window on the Caribbean, an open, prosperous society, proud. It has the second biggest festival in the whole world. So a very exciting place. And it's lost that sense of pride. And then it started to spiral down. So let's have a look at that spiraling down, how it works. And I'm going to start with an analogy, and it's of two dinghies sailing in a gusty wind, right? And one of the dinghies is hit by a gust, and it flips over. Right? It's now upside down. The other dinghy isn't hit by such a strong gust, so it stays upright. Okay? So one's now upright, one's upside down. Those of you who are in social science will know the technical term for these two positions is locally stable equilibria, right? Let's have a modicum of fancy, right? These are both locally stable equilibria. The upside down one is actually rather more locally stable than the right way up one, right? Anybody ever sailed a dinghy? Learned how to sail a sailing dinghy? No? One, yeah. You spend nearly all your time learning how to flip an upside down dinghy back up again because it's really difficult, right? So this upside down dinghy, the crew haven't learned how to flip it back up, right? So they are drifting backwards with the current in the wind, and you and the other dinghy is just sailing on where it wants to go. And now you're all going to play the role of market forces. Yeah? Put yourself in the position you've just got an MBA from the business school, right? Feel proud about yourselves. And now your job, your junior investment managers, right? You're in Goldman Sachs, let's give you it's fancy, right? So your job is to think, where should I invest the client's money? Should I invest it in this upside-down dinghy that's drifting backwards, or should I invest it in the right-ways-up dinghy that's sailing where they want to go? Right? It's not a very hard question, is it? Your market forces are going to go in the dinghy that stayed upright. Right? That's exactly the opposite of the expectations that Milton Friedman had. Milton Friedman, bless him, thought that, amazingly, this guy got a Nobel Prize in economics, right? So what he thought, he also had an image. Right? It wasn't an image of two dinghies. It was an image of a harp, right? And the string of a harp. When you pluck the string of a harp, the harp string wobbles around a bit, but goes back to where it was, right? And he said, that's how the world, that's market forces. So if a place is hit by a nasty shock, market forces will move money in because the land will be a bit cheaper, the workers will be a bit cheaper, and market forces will rush in. Yeah? You've just played market forces. Did they rush in? No, they didn't. So first of all, Friedman got his economics completely upside down, right? He was fancy, but he wasn't fancy enough, right? So that's the first rung down on the spiral, that market forces move you away from that upside down dinghy that needs it but doesn't get it to the right ways up dinghy. And then social forces move in. And I draw a lot on social psychology. And what's the social psychology going to be going on in this upside down dinghy? Yeah. The other dinghy didn't capsize, but you did. Yeah. Why did your dinghy capsize but not theirs? You know the right answer. One was hit by a gust of wind and the other wasn't. They don't know that. They just know their dinghy stayed upright, ours didn't. Why didn't ours stay upright? Well, you're the team of that dinghy that didn't stay upright. Was it you? No, it wasn't, you say. It's not my fault. Whose is it in this dinghy? Whose fault is it? It's her. Yeah, let's blame the woman. She's the odd one out. Oh, there's another one. Okay, we take a vote. Three men, two women. It's the women that let us down.
Sorry.
Yeah, you apologise, but not enough. It's too late. That's the social psychology. Now, you with the purple sweater, you have really pretty good with this dinghy. What are you doing with these dopes? There's the crew that was successful. It's just a short aisle. Nip across, you can move across, and then you join that successful team. That's what happens. So the social psychology of texts produce falling out and dissent in the team that should be struggling to work out how to flip the dinghy back up again. And the strongest quit and go and join the other team. Does that help the dinghy when you've left? No, it makes it harder. So that's the second spiral down. And I see it again and again. I see it in Barranquilla. I see it in Sheffield. I see it in Zambia. And it's very, very sad, because it's the process which happens. The real question comes: can that be reversed, and can it be avoided? So that's the first angry, rather sad part of Left Behind. Now, let me say, I've described it in simple, colourful terms, because I want a book that anybody can read. I want a book that voters can read at the moment, frankly, because I was part of the effort to what was called levelling up, which the blessed Boris introduced, right? And so I was actually appointed as an official advisor. Of course, I wasn't paid, but I was an official advisor to Michael Gove, who announced that levelling up was the flagship project of the government, right? Flagship project, it was announced as. And I was up there, photoed and all the rest of it, as the expert advisor to this mission. And I stayed and I watched, and I gradually realized this thing is a farce. It's the worst. I was going to say theater. There's some very valuable things about theater, but this is just the worst, the most pejorative sense of theater, right? It was performative, but it was a lie. It was a deliberate deception on the public, the appearance that something was happening and nothing was. I've distanced myself from it, shall we say. So that was the shameful thing that I saw in Britain. And let me pass it back to you.
Okay. Yeah, you also, on top of this, of the dynamics you've just been describing, point the finger at centralised decision-making, centralised bureaucracy. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about that, the need for local, but also the need for that, you know, with eyes wide open about, you know, what are the risks of that, and then perhaps moving on to local agency and how that connects.
Absolutely. So Britain, and especially England, is a very unique form of governance. And I hope you realise just how unique it is. It is quite astonishingly highly centralised. Government decisions are in Whitehall, and financial decisions are in the finance industry centred in London. So let's stick with Whitehall for a minute. So Whitehall has extraordinary powers over the rest of the country. But it's worse than that. It's not just Whitehall, it's within Whitehall. Where is the power? And the real power lies with the Treasury. Andy Burnham, Mayor of Greater Manchester, said, Britain seems to be run by about 50 people, basically in the Treasury. He's just won the right to plan bus routes in Manchester. Before that, the bus routes for Manchester were planned in the Treasury by kids who'd perhaps never been to Manchester. Yeah. So is this a sensible way of planning bus routes in the country? It's ridiculous, frankly, and it's so absurd, it doesn't happen anywhere else. So it's very highly centralised. Not only that, the Treasury is very, very overconfident. Why? Because they're all clever kids. I taught many of them, right? Clever kids who passed all their exams in economics. Well, we teach them a lot about how to plan bus routes in Sheffield in economics, absolutely. You know. So they're very clever. Because of that, they're overconfident. And that's pretty dangerous combination when you've got a lot of power and you're overconfident. And then the worst feature comes in. The worst feature of the Treasury is it's very, very short-termist. There's one core function that the Treasury has each year, and that is setting a budget. And what's this budget about? It's trying to satisfy huge demands for spending with limited revenue. And so it's always a scramble at the last minute. What can we cut? What can we cut? What can we cut that won't howl? So what can we cut at the last minute that won't be a lobby jumping up and down, howling? I'll tell you what we can cut and what we do cut. The future. There's no voice for investment in the future. And so we have the lowest expenditure on public infrastructure in Western Europe. And by God, it shows, right? If you add these things together, incredibly short-termist, incredibly overconfident, incredibly centralised, once you move outside London, if you ever do, you will find that in the rest of England, the transport system is terrible, the education system is terrible because the spending is very heavily biased towards where the kids in the Treasury come from. And they're diverse in gender now, they're diverse in ethnicity, they're not diverse in the part of the country they're from. If you take the bottom 20% of communities around the country, deprived communities, how many of those Treasury officials have any lived experience of life in deprivation? None. And that is a terrible indictment upon the social composition of the Treasury. I've done a lot of work on this, and so have other people, and it is extraordinarily socially exclusive, even by the standards of Whitehall. There's one nice little story in the book of a permanent secretary who went to a good private school, i.e. public school in British parlance. So he went to a good private school, and from there his parents had a good education and they sent him to a good university. But it wasn't Oxford or Cambridge. And so he felt, as a permanent secretary, he felt a complete outsider. Now, if he's an outsider, a good private school, a good university, and then making it to the top of the Treasury, to the top of the civil service, the permanent secretary, if he feels an outsider, what chance for the kids from deprived areas in the rest of England? Every region of England, except for London, voted Brexit. Every single region.
Yeah? Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Paul, can I stop you there? Because we have a few more minutes, and I want to go beyond the UK.
Okay.
So
you can ask any questions.
So yeah, you can do part of that job. You can do with questions. But really, before we finish, I want to do two things. I want to focus on the very important part of the book, which talks about shifting decision making to the local level and the importance of local agency. And we'll have to do this succinctly, because then I also want to talk about the vision for the future. So so if you could talk about first the importance of the local system, some of the problems and challenges, and then also the role of local agencies.
Thank you. So, absolutely. So, what's the answer to all this? Devolve. Goodness sake. I mean, decision-taking is so much easier at a local level, where people know more about the context, and it's much easier to coordinate between the different parts of the public service. Just like in Sheffield, they managed to coordinate between business and workers. If you can span that bridge, you can certainly span these other bridges. So devolve, devolve, devolve. And then, having devolved, what people need is agency. Local government in Britain has no agency. There's no money, no powers. In fact, all it's got is obligations, which is the prerogative of the sucker through the ages. So that the blame for failure lands on the local government, because it's got constitutional requirements to do things that it can't possibly do on its tiny budget. Because voters know that local government hasn't got any powers, they don't turn out and vote. And so we've got very low turnout. Elsewhere in Europe, it's not like that. There's much more devolved power, much more agency lying with local governments. You know, in Germany, 70% of public spending is done by local governments. By God, Germans turn out in droves. The turnout in a typical local election in Germany is somewhere around 80%. It's somewhere around 20% in Britain. So that's where we've got to rebuild to, is sharing agency, getting the agency out of these tiny little group of people and spreading it more broadly around the country. That will take a long time. It'll take a generation to change that. If we never start, you know how long it'll take? Eternity, right? Which is quite a long time to hang around. So devolve, spread agency, and then Labour has a chance to do this now. I don't know whether they'll do it. I don't know whether Starmer will do it. But he has a chance. And that takes us to the more hopeful two-thirds of the book. There's so much that can be done to enable a poor region that's fallen behind to catch up. Around the world, except in England, regions do catch up. And so there's much that we can learn from others about how to do so.
Do you want to give a couple of examples and then we'll open it up for questions?
Yeah. I'll give an example from, let's take something that's not a million miles away, Germany. Germany, 1992, unification of West and East Germany. And there's a conservative head of government, Kohl. So, you know, he was equivalent to Boris. What did Boris do? I can tell you. He went on holiday. Right? What did Kohl do in unification? First, he said, this will take 30 years or more, a whole generation, to enable East Germany to catch up. Second, he said, I won't be in power for the next 30 years. In fact, my party won't be in power for 30 years. So the next thing he did was build a cross-party alliance. So all the major political parties in Germany endorsed the same objective. We've got to enable East Germany to catch up. Then what did he do? He put big money into it. He, dare I say it, he raised taxes. He called it a solidarity tax, and they raised them a lot, right? And he went to Germans, and West Germans, and he said, It is, we're all citizens of Germany, the new unified Germany. We in West Germany are damn lucky that the line that used to separate us, who determined that line? It was the Russian troops versus the American troops. It wasn't anything to do with us. We were just damn lucky to be on the right side. Yeah? Now, having been damn lucky, it's our moral duty to contribute to enable the unlucky people who are on the other side to catch up. It's our moral duty to pay this tax. We're citizens of a united Germany. And this is something we'll do. Did he achieve it? When East Germany joined West Germany, its productivity was 20% of West German level, 20%. Now, 30 years later, it's 85%. Germans think of it as a big failure because they see it's still 15% behind. And if you follow German politics, you know that's deeply resented in the East. I tell Germans, compared to us, it's a resounding success. Because here's the tragic side of it. East Germany, at unification, was very much poorer than South Yorkshire, the poorest region in England. Very much poorer. Now, East Germany is very much more productive than South Yorkshire. And so what the Germans did, what Kohl did, really worked. Solidarity tax, devolve the money so that it's spent by East Germans in East Germany. It worked. What did we do in Britain? We know what we did, right? 50 kids in the Treasury decided to run South Yorkshire. No agency, no devolution. Did we learn? Did we learn from that failure? And to my mind, the most dispiriting thing is that the Treasury is so overconfident that it's refused to learn from repeated failure. That is truly dangerous. Right? And so, I've got a vote in Britain. If you've got a vote in Britain, use it. Will Labour be better? I don't know. What I do know is that nearly all the mayorships around Britain are now held by Labour. Those guys will be a voice in the Labour Party saying, for goodness sake, devolve, give us agency, give us the resources that with which we can reset the future.
Yeah? Great. Thanks very much, Paul. Let's open it up to questions. For those of you who are online, please type your questions into the Q&A box, and we'll try to answer as many of those as possible. For those of you here, please raise your hands as you're doing, and we'll have people come by with a roving mic. So first, this woman with the red sweater here, and I'll take three. So the gentleman there, who's just one in from the aisle, and then over here. So the person who's there in the fourth row up. From the bottom. Yeah, so just keep your hand raised until you get a mic. I'll then come for a second round. So I'll just take those three for now.
Thank you. My question is, if we move to this model of devolved governance, will those 50 kids in the Treasury not just move to Birmingham or those cities where there is power and prestige and those high-profile jobs? And then we'll just have the same problem of overconfident people with too much power, with that lack of social diversity just spread around the country. How do we actually get people from a background of deprivation and lower socioeconomic backgrounds into those top jobs?
Great, thanks. Second question here.
Thank you. You talk about devolved power, and I think it should go to local authorities. One fly in the ointment is nationalism. You talk about England, but they try to devolve power to the countries, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, and in Scotland it has not worked at all. Your example of ships kind of thing, the Clyde used to be the greatest shipbuilding area in the world and it declined. The SNP thought they could revive it by building ferries, you know, for the Isles, new transport system. Yep. It failed. The company that built them took 5 years and their shoddy workmanship.
Yeah.
I think it's new industries we have to be investing in, and local authorities.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. Also, this gentleman here.
Yeah, thank you for your talk. My question is simple. So you kind of distinguish between two causes for industries and geographies being left behind. You have favoritism and industrial policies on the one hand, but you also have, and we need to recognize, more natural causes like business cycles and innovation, etc. So what do you see, like what are the relative strengths of these two? Which one do you think is more pressing? And do you think both of these causes warrant an intervention?
Thanks very much. So, lady in red, will all these elites just move to Birmingham and then still be elites? For that, we need to counter the huge inequalities in life chances in Britain. That can be done. Right? It doesn't have to be. We at the moment have these incredibly unequal life chances. That can be tackled. It'll be a long, slow job. It starts with much better preschool education, then goes. But the key point at the moment is the passage between primary school and secondary school, where the evidence is that clever kids from working class backgrounds in primary school then get overtaken by much less clever kids who've had the right parents in the right place. And so that is something that we can fix. It's a very I always try and nail down where the problem's happening and then rectify it. The most decisive errors at the moment are with GCSEs. I know because I've got two kids just taking the exams now. If you're in, I'll give you maths as an example. If you're in the top third of maths at GCSE in Britain, your chances of going on to get a degree in some subject or other is 70%. If you're in the bottom third of that maths exam at age 16, your chances of passing to a university are 4%. Huh? 70% versus 4%, sorted at 16. That is crazy. It is crazy, and it's unique. No other serious country has that sort of abandonment of its the bottom third of kids in their country, bottom third in just one dimension. You measure in one dimension, and then you write them off. Right? These are really fixable problems because you can pinpoint them. We shouldn't be doing that. Let's turn to devolved power in Scotland. One of my proudest claims is that I've been many times to Glasgow. I got an award from Glasgow Philosophical Society, of which I'm very proud. Scotland and the SNP. The SNP is first and foremost a nationalist party. And like all nationalist parties, it's in the end selling a false bill of goods. The idea that the solution to our problems is national, the Scottish nation. Right? And it's just not true. Right? Scotland, like the rest of Britain, needs to be better integrated into markets in Europe. For a start, right? The Brexit was a disaster. Right? Why did every region of England vote for Brexit? Because they were misled. Because they so many regions were neglected, people felt despair and anger. And so here was a chance to hurt London. And so they voted it. They voted for Brexit. Actually, they were hurting themselves much more than London. Because the north of England was the big export area to Europe. London doesn't really need Europe. Its big markets are global. So let's go back and think of what's in London's self-interest. If we go back to, say, the year 2000, 24 years ago, Would it have been in London's interest to say, well, actually, you regions, the rest of you, you can't be falling that much further year by year behind London. We have a duty, just like those German citizens, to help you catch up. That would be the reaching out by the rich regions to the rest and saying, we've got a duty as citizens of Britain to help the regions that are diverging catch up again. If we'd done that, we wouldn't have had Brexit. We wouldn't have had Scottish nationalism either, right? So these false narratives, the Boris Johnsons of this world, the SNPs of this world, selling a bogus bill of goods, which is clutched at by the desperate. Of course Glasgow voted for Scottish nationalists. Why? Because they were left behind in despair and anger, and here was something that sounded, if you didn't interrogate it too closely, sounded plausible. All our problems are because of England. No. Industrial policy. What is it? Whatever industrial policy means, it doesn't necessarily mean industry. We're not trying to bring shipbuilding back to Glasgow. That's a touch of nostalgia that's a bridge too far, right? What we want is a forward-looking industrial policy, which probably won't be industry, but says what in each region is the big opportunities, right? And often the best people to think about that are the people in the region. They can say, what's distinctive about our region? And I try and advise people, don't think about your distinctive features as problems that cause you to be spiraling down. The more distinctive you are, the better your opportunities. I've got three kids, I've taught them, the more unusual your characteristics, if they survived the fierce furnace of evolution, every characteristic that survived that fierce furnace is useful to the group. Otherwise, we would have filtered it out. We'd have, right? It's useful to the group. All you've got to do, the more unusual your characteristics, I've got one kid who's deeply dyslexic, so bad he can't read, right? It turns out that's a huge advantage in one occupation, architecture. A lot of architects will only employ people who are dyslexic. They see the world differently. Huh? So he's doing extremely well at the Bartlett School of Architecture and so on. So every characteristic of a region that's distinctive, look at it as something that's valuable.
The first question we've got is from Peter, who was a former advisor in local government in dealing with central government, and he endorses the comments made on centralisation and asks, why has it happened, and politically, how can the straitjacket on local agencies be forcibly removed?
And let's take two from the room. So,
Hello, my name's Noah Hughes. I'm from the Centre for Systemic Economic Thinking. And my question is, well, first, you've talked a lot about decentralisation, but I want to look at it from a different angle. Have you considered the importance of decentralising money creation, which is primarily in the hands of large institutional private banks?
And then the final question there for the gentleman.
One question I had is around globalisation. So a lot of the issues, obviously there's issues around centralisation that have caused problems in places like Sheffield, but a lot of it has been because of increased globalisation. We've had competition from places that can produce it far more cheaply, just pragmatically, based on, you know, the market forces you alluded to earlier. So in light of that, and in light of the fact that decisions like Brexit, the popularity of Trump, can be seen almost in like an anti-globalisation sense, that people want to return back to our roots, well, where do you see the future of globalisation in this debate?
Why has centralisation happened? In Britain, we've centralised because, remember, overconfident, very short-termist, but especially overconfident. And so has it worked? Has it all worked? Is Britain now great? Are we all saying, thank God we're British? No, right? The latest evidence, the lowest trust in government we've ever had is Britain. Now, right? So Why did it happen? Because of a misdiagnosis of the failures. Did the Treasury notice the failures? Just about, yes, just about. What was the diagnosis? Why are we failing? Because we don't have enough control. And so the Treasury took back control. It centralized even more. Does that make things better if your big problem is that you're over-centralized, overconfident? No. Right? So it was a spectacular misdiagnosis brought about by spectacular overconfidence and a refusal to think that you could be wrong. Right? Decentralized money, crypto? No. Definitely not crypto, right? That would be a terrible idea, right? A truly terrible idea. I don't want to go any further on that one, but if ever there was a false god, selling the crypto idea is it, right? Future of globalization. That's an interesting question. In the interest of time, you're going to have to read the book, but but quite clearly, the world is moving towards friendshoring, towards regions of influence and all that jazz. Will it be a return to the 1930s? No, it won't be as bad as that. I think we've learned our lesson. It's not going to be a retreat into individual country protectionism. Thank God we've got the WTO and so forth. But I do think it will be a contest for the next 50 years between basically China with its little satrap Russia and America and India. I think the decisive role will actually be played by India. So I see the future as being decided by India. Unfortunately, India at the moment is under Modi, who's at least had quite a big dose of reality very recently. Let me close with a remark. I wrote Left Behind. I rewrote it 30 times to make it readable and fun to read. And I think it is fun to read. It's full of what I think witticisms. And I've pilot tested it on young people. I wrote it in principle so that you could read this on a beach and enjoy it. And I met today somebody who'd done exactly that. They read it on a beach and enjoyed it. But don't let the fact that it's an easy, fun read fool you into thinking it's bad economics. It's actually very sophisticated economics. Some of it is really quite new. I thought I was sticking my neck out professionally when I wrote Left Behind. I've discovered I've not stuck my neck out. I've already got this. I've got very fancy economists, much fancier than me, who are piling in to agree with it. Right? I've got two Nobel Prizes in economics who have been saying, yes, this is right. I've got Raghu Rajan in India saying, yes, this is right. I've got much fancier people than the Treasury can possibly line up. And I'm just waiting with glee, because there's one spectacular incompetence in the Treasury, which we've not discussed tonight. It's there in the book, and I'm just waiting for the Treasury to explode with anger, and then we'll move in with the damning evidence that supports it, number by brutal number. Right? The Treasury is not even competent when it's trying to do things it really believes in, which is raising taxes. When it turns to things that it doesn't even believe in, like letting the regions catch up, it's dreadful. Right? So on that note, please read the book. We all have agency, and that includes you. Right? I've had the agency to write a book that's clear and fun to read, and I think you'll find it is. You have the agency on social media. do I know how to do social media? Get real, right? You do know how to get to do social media. Get active. You have agency, use it. If you don't use your agency to do that, there are other people on social media. What are they peddling? They're peddling crypto, they're peddling nationalism, they're peddling every damn lie in the book, right? So if you sit on your hands and say, oh, I don't want to sully my hands with getting into social media, I'll just look at the stories of cats and things like that, right? If you do nothing, it's your future. And let me predict what your future will be if you clever people do nothing. And here I'm going to use a technical economics word again. It will be shit.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.